A busy edition of Connecticut Today for Thursday, August 6th, day two of the cleanup after Tropical Storm Isaias hit Connecticut. We kept you updated on all the power outage numbers and such on the storm cleanup. Also, we checked in with one of our go-to guys for politics, Dr. Gary Rose, chairman of the Poli-Sci Department, Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, on the state of the presidential race, and who might Joe Biden pick to be vice president. We covered Governor Ned Lamont's news conference in the 4 o'clock hour about COVID-19 and the post-storm cleanup. And our buddy Brian Forster joined us from InStoresNow.com to talk about UConn being the first major college football program to drop its entire schedule for the coming season. Been talking a little bit more about something that made a whole lot of reporters kind of scratch their heads yesterday. A major presidential candidate re-asking an African-American established television journalist if he was a junkie during an interview. Dr. Gary Rose is here, Sacred Heart University, government, poli-sci chair and all that. Gary, how are you?
Good. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm all right. I hope you are nice and relaxed where you are. Hopefully no trees fell anywhere near you, which would not be a good thing.
You know, we did get quite a few down up here in Cheshire where I live. The crews are out right now cleaning up yards.
Not an easy thing to do, yards or poles at all.
Absolutely not.
Joe Biden, Gary, he asked a gentleman, a British gentleman who works for CBS, I believe, if he was a junkie during a question about whether he takes cognitive testing. What do you think of that, Gary?
Well, it seems as if maybe Mr. Biden, former Vice President Biden, is getting a little defensive and maybe apprehensive as the election draws near and becoming a little more combative with the press. And so it's difficult to tell actually what's going on with him in that whole cognitive issue, but we do know that I think that the accusations that are out there go beyond just President Trump now. And so it wouldn't surprise me if the former vice president is really feeling the heat on that issue.
And Gary, you know, people were saying to me last night, we're conversing with my political friends, and saying, well, he's just trying to be funny. That's Joe being Joe. But I think my point, Gary, is if people have these doubts about you, wouldn't you just kind of laugh off that question and say, yeah, I'm tested all the time. Yes. My wife tests me. My dog tests me. My kids test me. But I think I'm okay. You know, the answer didn't help.
Yeah, when somebody asks a question like that, and it really does seem to be coming, you know, out of the blue, and it really doesn't. And if you do feel in your heart that it has absolutely no merit, then yes, you're correct. You laugh it off and you just move on. But to have a response and a retort like that, I think it really does show that maybe he's feeling that this election is drawing near, and people are really thinking that about me. And it's not a laughing matter to him. In other words.
Yeah. Gary, hang on. I'll be right back with you. Want to talk about the whole vice presidential pick, which has not been made yet. Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University, one of our political go-to guys with us for a few minutes. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on a Thursday at WICC. As we stop and talk a little national politics here for a few moments with one of our go-to guys, Dr. Gary Rose, professor in the Poli-Sci Department, chairman of government, too, at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, the whole vice presidential pick thing, it's a little late. He said he would do it last week. Axios had a story yesterday that it's between Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, which is kind of interesting. And you probably saw the same things I did, Gary, that apparently Chris Dodd is not a real big fan of Kamala Harris. He is heading the whole VP search, and he is making that known, I guess, that he did not like what she did to his old buddy Joe Biden during those first couple of debates.
Yeah, I know. She really tried to paint him as very insensitive to racial minorities. In fact, in some respects, she was implying that he was a racist. And But, you know, with vice presidential decisions, lots of times we do have these, if you want to call them, you know, conflicts between the candidates. And it seems like when they come together as a ticket, all is well. And you kind of sweep under the carpet a lot of the things you said, and you just put it behind you, and then the campaign begins. So it wouldn't be certainly the first time that we had a vice presidential running mate who made pretty harsh accusations against the individual who's choosing her, and so, or him, I should say. So it's par for the course. It really is. And that's particularly true when you have somebody who is and also ran, such as Kamala Harris. When you have somebody up on stage with you, obviously, and you're competing for your party's nomination, you really need to expect that they're going to go after you. But then, you know, things heal very quickly when the race begins and you're on the ticket together. It really does.
And Gary, obviously, you're right. Myriad examples, you know, George Bush, Reagan was practicing voodoo economics.
Voodoo economics, yeah, that's right.
LBJ and JFK.
Good God.
God, if people read about that, no, they had no love lost for each other. You can even go back, Gary, to, and I'm a little bit of a historian, I love reading old stuff, you can go back to FDR. You know, he was warned not to pick Henry Wallace
because he
turned out to be a leftist, and that's why he had to eventually go with Harry Truman.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know. That was a huge choice, too, with Harry Truman. It was a controversial choice. There wasn't any type of conflict between the two, but nevertheless, Harry Truman, people just kind of looked at as this senator from Missouri who really was in many ways, you know, just a little too plain spoken and maybe a little too simplistic to take that position. And then certainly he really filled FDR's shoes tremendously. But the choice of a running mate this time is, I think, looms larger than in the past. Largely, to get back to your first question about Joe Biden's cognitive ability and his state of mind. And I think virtually everybody that you talk to out on the street, too, that's following this race, has the feeling that his vice presidential choice, should he win the election, will be in many ways the key figure in the White House making decisions, particularly when Joe Biden says he only plans on being a president for one term.
He terms himself a transitional guy, a guy to get us back to normal.
And then you're immediately a lame duck when you make that statement.
That's a good point. You know, Gary, I had a relative of mine ask me, we're having a conversation the other night, and my relative said, how is it in the year 2020 when we have all these supposed great political minds? He said to me, Paul, how the heck is it that we're left with one guy who we have doubts about his mental capacity and the other guy who can't control himself? He goes, can I please have some normality? I mean, your students, Gary, must look at you and say, was it like this, professor, when you grew up?
Well, you know, it is sort of an unusual type of situation that we have right now. But when you really look back on it, you know, a lot of candidates, when particularly historically, were also some of them were loose cannons. And so it's true. Donald Trump is a very unpredictable individual, very belligerent and very egotistical. But, you know, we've had people like that before and we survived. So it's, you know, it's really everybody is. I do think this is a critical election in terms of the direction this country is going to take. But in terms of the actual character of the candidates, the quality of the two nominees, which inevitably, you know, they're both the nominees. We've been there before in some respects with some very unusual people running for president. It's happened.
Where's Harold Stassen when you need him?
Gary,
final question. Kind of a little bit of a sidebar story here. The continued influx, but some little pushback on the uber progressives in the Democratic Party. You had a first-time candidate take out Lacey Clay in Missouri, a long-time established, and no conservative, a liberal long-time from a long political lineage in Missouri. And I'm seeing today, however, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, I don't know whether you saw this, they endorsed Ilhan Omar's challenger. And here's Minneapolis, who is hardly a conservative area, we know that, saying, no, this is a little too far left even for us. You know, the times, they are a-changing, as Bob Dylan said.
Yeah, sometimes people overshoot, and I think that in the case of Omar, that's an example. That's not to say that she's not going to be back in Congress, but at the same time, you know, progressives are, it's a very strong strain of Democratic Party politics these days, but even then, sometimes even the progressives start to feel a little, you know, pragmatic and start to see that, wait a minute, maybe we need to just kind of put the brakes on some of these individuals. And Omar is a perfect example of that. I mean, I saw her the other day on TV saying that, you know, once the election is over and the Democrats come to power, we need to tear down the political and the economic system. I mean, what kind of a, you know, I would say if I was a left-wing progressive, I'd also probably say, good God, wait a minute. I don't think that's what we're trying to do.
We're trying to tear down the system.
And you know what's really amazing is here's this woman that really has risen to a position of power in a system that was far superior to her own, you know, her own roots. And you would think somebody would be very, you know, appreciative of the system that has put her where she is. But it was an amazing statement to me. It really was.
And maybe that, you know, maybe the editorial board heard that and said, no, can't do that. Gary, thank you as always. Take care. Enjoy the rest of the summer, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Okay, Paul.
Appreciate it, Gary, as always. Thanks for taking the time. Our professor on political science issues, Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chairman of the Department of Government, just down the road from us at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Go Pioneers.
Talk about the tropical storm, and Katie Dykes, our deep commissioner, will be able to answer questions as regards the progress we're making, slow progress in getting everybody reactivated. Let me just say a little bit about tropical storm Isaias and the recovery. By the way, I finally found out where the name came from. Sean Wooden's son, he's our treasurer, is named Isaias. So that's the one good thing I can say about this tropical storm. It hit us really hard. Almost half of all homes lost power. That's one of the worst in the history of this state. We've had a lot of meetings with Eversource and UI, the two major utilities here serving the state of Connecticut. And today, as you can see here, Eversource outages still represent about 40% of their customers. That's 40%. 517,000 people still without service. They fixed about 330,000. They were up well over 800,000, you know, a few days ago. They focused primarily on clearing trees, making things road ready. That's part of the 250 roads that are still blocked, but we've made good progress on that over a period of time. And they've had to look at the transmission lines. Those are the major trunk lines that feed the substations. You got to get them activated first before you can start taking on the individual pockets of customers without service. UI has done better. At least they have a much lower percentage of their customers without power. That's 22%. And I think Katie said they look to have the majority of them up in the next 48 hours. There have been five serious injuries, a couple of fatalities, sadly. People often in a car and a tree comes down. I was sort of interested in terms of, we had one of our unified command calls this morning, one of, where all the commissioners are on board, plus the utilities, plus the telecom companies. It's really where everybody affected or affecting the electric grid is on, plus all of our key commissioners. And Eversource gave their briefing, UI gave their briefing, and then they said, tell us about any critical facilities that we should prioritize in terms of getting service back, and those that maybe are just now temporarily operating with an electric generator. And all of a sudden, we heard from everybody. The public safety said our troop barracks are down. And if you care about public safety, you can't just rely upon the generators. Kurt Westby, Department of Labor, they've had a lot of work to do, as you maybe know, since COVID and all the unemployment claims. And now they're working on an old generator right now. And he said if this generator goes, that will impact 300,000 unemployment claims coming forward. We got that generator. It's still going, and we're making that a priority. You know, Katie will tell us about the wastewater treatment facilities and, frankly, the freshwater treatment and our 36 public systems, all of which require electric in order to process the water in both ways. Otherwise, there are spills on the wastewater side and tougher time getting fresh water out. Those are right now operating with generators, but generators can last 4 or 5 days. You got to have access to them, and it's a lot riskier proposition. Nursing homes, we were told that about a third of our nursing homes now are not on the grid, but they are there with generator backup power. Although in one case, Deirdre said the generator went down. You had to get there very quickly because you couldn't have seniors in 90-degree darkness, and they did take care of that. The telecom guys, you know, Frontier, Verizon, AT&T, the folks that make your cell phone work, you know, they said, look, we've got our cell towers. They have battery backup. That's a good thing. But the backhaul necessary sometimes to route that is a little bit of risk right now. You may see some effect on your cell phone service. Again, this was another piece of, quote, critical facilities that we had to really prioritize. And then we finally got to the Department of Agriculture, and I said, I can relax here. But then I found out that there are hundreds of thousands of chickens that cannot be fed without electricity. I thought maybe you could just throw out the grass seed, but I'm living in the past. And these chickens, they need electricity not just for feeding but for ventilation or they die. So these are the ideas. This is the scope of what we are prioritizing as we get electric back to each and every one of you. And I got to tell you, in no uncertain terms, we're going to be riding hard to make sure we get this done. I can tell you that Eversource, maybe only had 450 line crews a few days ago. They'll have over 1,100 within the next 24 hours. And I really want to see more progress. I can't have a senior who's living alone with no electricity and no air conditioning, waiting day upon day upon day for support. This next slide gives you just an idea of some of the what we're doing. This gives you an idea of, look, the nature of the collapses of the trees on the power wires and the lines that are going down. And we fixed hundreds, but we still, as you saw from the other slide, still have over 250 block roads. And you got to get them fixed first so that the vans can go necessary to get power to everybody else. Look, we're going to have plenty of time to figure out what went right and what went wrong and how we could have done better. And PURA, which is the regulatory body of which Katie used to be chairman, is going to be taking a good, hard, investigative look to see, A, all the money that we have spent at the ratepayers' expense over the last 10 years, what that has meant in terms of hardening our critical infrastructure, hardening our electric grid, protecting it, the status monitoring we need, and why we, after 10 years of those investments, we still suffered such a hit with almost half of people losing their power going forward. So we're going to have plenty of time to Monday morning quarterback this, but right now our priority is getting you power back as soon as we can. And I know there's hundreds of questions, and I can't leave you in the dark in terms of what's next, when can my power go on, and I've been told not to make any promises on behalf of others except for the fact that we're going to be focused like a laser beam until each and every one of you gets your service back. This grid, I think, speaks for itself, but there's the email or the website as well as the telephone number for UI and Eversource. And of course, our friends at United Way, 211, as we try and route these signals and get you answers as best we can. I think it's going to take another day or so before Eversource can give a broader commitment in terms of how and when they get everybody turned on. But we'll have that for you as soon as we possibly can. So that's the first part of our briefing. Now let's get back to our regularly scheduled programming, which is the COVID-19 daily summary. And I consider this pretty good news, now 6 weeks running. No fatalities for 3 days in a row. Hospitalizations up a little bit. We've talked about that before. The positive cases, 20 out of almost 9,000. That's a 0.2% positivity rate. That is by far the best we've been since the start of COVID. And we're trending, not trending in the right direction, but holding the line, and this is a very good number. Of course, you know, I'm paid to worry, and Rhode Island, our neighbor, is there at about 5%, and Massachusetts, our other good neighbor, is there at about 3%. So, and COVID doesn't know these state borders. But that said, Connecticut still has all the metrics in place that allow us to proceed cautiously with the rest of our reopening plan. Which gets us to probably what will be the second half of our briefing, Max. This is the safely reopening the schools. And what I really wanted to be able to explain with Miguel's help and Melissa McCaw, who's here together, they've been working with all the superintendents. As you know, a few weeks ago, we got the first draft from the superintendents on how they could open schools safely. And we asked them to go forward with a full in-class program, a hybrid program, and a distance learning program in case the metrics changed and we couldn't do this safely. And what Melissa and Miguel have done is broken down in terms of priorities all the things that we, the state of Connecticut, will provide for our teachers, for our students, for our parents, and for our school systems to keep you safe. And I think you know from our last meeting, as soon as we don't think we can do this safely, we change course. So what we have committed here is $266 million to help our districts safely reopen. And Melissa reminds me, this is by far, you know, most of this comes from our COVID relief fund, the federal money we got. And this is by far one of the biggest allocations, the biggest allocation to school safety of any of our Northeast regional states. So I think you know how seriously we're taking this. You know, I'd say that of the $266 million, 99 of it has already been allocated previously to the districts. That's money for you to invest as you see fit over and above what we are doing on the state level. But I would say over 50% is related to PPE and everything you need in terms of a disinfectant and support to make sure that your school is safe, make sure your teachers are safe, make sure everybody has the mask as needed. That's us, the state of Connecticut, providing that in no uncertain terms. The next biggest piece is related to staffing. And there we've got about $50 million allocated for our school districts. And staffing could be a variety of different things. Staffing could be social and emotional learning to provide support for our kids, most of whom have been really socially isolated for a long time, coming back to a new situation. Some of that is related to what we're calling apprentice teachers, or others who will be able to fill in the classrooms, since some of our older teachers or those with a pre-existing condition will probably have to teach via Zoom and can't be in the classroom. Those are the type of priorities that we have over and above the $90 million that's going directly to each and every one of you, the schools shared amongst you, so you can prioritize other. You know, smaller is transportation, just because some of the school districts will require some additional bus support, and we have, I think, 3 months of people there to help monitor students on the buses they go forward. If you heard before, we've made a big commitment in terms of technology, the Chromebooks, hot zones, Wi-Fi, direct links to make sure that any of the parents who don't feel comfortable with their kids going back to school, we can take care of you in terms of distance learning. So I think this gives you an idea of the priorities we got, the fact that the teachers in the schools, we got your back. We're putting our money where our mouth is and prioritizing all the ways that you can get back to school safely. You know, so with that, why don't we just open up to questions, which I think would be easiest to do. As I said before, Miguel is here as regards. He's been leading the discussions with all of our superintendents. Katie's been working very closely with our utilities. Melissa, as you know, from OPM, as I run those numbers with Miguel, can give more context. And Paul and Josh, everybody knows what they do. Back to you, Max.
News 8.
Governor, when you talk about holding as many people accountable as you possibly can, what does that mean in terms of moving forward, any type of fines or action taken against the power companies?
Want to try that, Katie?
So the governor yesterday called on PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, to open an investigation to ensure that as we move forward and pass the restoration of power and immediate addressing this emergency, that there will be a full and transparent investigation into the utilities' response. One of the items that the governor asked PURA to consider and investigate in that docket is whether civil penalties should be assessed to the utilities based on their performance. And, of course, those penalties would come from shareholders and not from ratepayers of the utilities. PURA did respond and open that docket today. And so we will be looking forward to participating in that docket to ensure that the ratepayers of the state get a clear accounting for how their dollars have been spent and the performance from the utilities that we all rely on.
And for Miguel, because the whole situation is so fluid, has anything changed in the last week or so moving forward? Or because the numbers are still good, things right now are pretty much as they were, say, a week ago in trying to move forward?
I think the data just supports the encouragement of bringing students in to the schoolhouse as much as possible. So I think, you know, we're continuing with the message that we know remote learning is not the ideal option for students, and where possible, get the students in to give them that in-school experience. And, you know, thankfully the data supports that. I'm really pleased with the data from today, and I think that just supports the work of our districts to get students in person.
Hey, Miguel, I think you told me that about 55% of the schools look to have in-classroom.
Right. We had a recent information come back to the State Department of Education, and by and large, our districts agree, our district leaders agree. Over 55% are planning full in-person learning. 44% are planning hybrid, some form of hybrid, but that could include buildings that have full in-person learning. For example, elementary might be coming in, and maybe just their high schools are going hybrid. So throughout the state of Connecticut, I think most agree that we need to get our students in the classroom learning in a safe environment.
Fox 61.
Governor, you mentioned that you're launching the National Guard to help restore power. When will this happen, and what determines what areas they will hit first in the state?
Well, it happens immediately, and right now, I think Paul can help me out with this, but I think primarily we've got roads we got to clear, and that'll be one of their priorities. And I just want to say on behalf of the National Guard, I wasn't positive what the National Guard did 2 years ago. I sure know now. I mean, I was down at Guantanamo. I see these guys guarding prisoners. I saw them building field hospitals during the peak of COVID when we might be overrun. Now they're clearing roads and doing a lot of frontline work. They're amazing. Paul?
Yeah, I'll add to that point. General Ivan has done an amazing job in leading through. They will be embedded with both UI and with Eversource. Do debris removal that will allow for the make safe priorities of various towns to be able to be accomplished. They are already starting. They're going to be going up in the air starting tonight, and then it will also be fully embedded starting first thing tomorrow morning. The governor made that announcement and that declaration, and General Ivan and his team got right to work as they always do. And we thank them for always stepping up to the call.
And then with the extra help, is the time frame still the same for some residents? Those that want to prepare for the worst, are they looking at like a Sunday, Monday in terms of when people could see their electric back up and running?
I'm happy to respond to that one.
Sure.
So as as whenever we have a storm that hits, the utilities are required to follow an emergency response plan, and that involves first assessing the damage, addressing critical facilities, and within a reasonable period of time after they've done that assessment, providing an estimate of when they expect the majority of their customers to be restored to power. United Illuminating has provided that estimate, clarifying that they announced it at 2 o'clock today that they expect to have the majority of their customers restored by the end of Saturday. We're continuing to wait on Eversource's report. They have indicated to the governor that they will be providing that estimate later today. And once we have that, they will be telling us when they expect the majority of their customers to be restored. But we don't have that estimate at this time.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon. Governor Craig Hellstrom with Eversource just said that the cost of this will ultimately end up in customers' bills. I just wanted to get your reaction to that statement.
I think that's why we're going to have a Puro investigation. I think that's why Puro has put any rate increase on hold for now. So let's leave it at that.
And how much of the problems and issues that we're seeing right now do you actually attribute to Eversource's lack of preparedness? In other words, do you feel that another utility company, say National Grid, could have reacted faster and done more?
Well, let's start with the fact that this was a brutal storm that hit us and far exceeded just about any hit we've had. I know it wasn't a broad-based hurricane with those winds, but those tornado-like winds that really hit through caused extraordinary damage. That said, my philosophy has always been hope for the best and plan for the worst. And I think that Eversource didn't plan for the worst. I don't think they had the people staged in place ready to go as soon as we saw the scope of what was happening. You know, but there's plenty of time to look back. I'm looking forward right now. We've got to get more people on the ground, more boots on the ground. We get the roads cleared, get those main transportation hubs going. Those transition hubs going, and then focus on getting people turned back on. And I am going to push every day to make that happen.
And lastly, are you concerned at all about the primary?
About the primary? Yeah, this came up a little bit because a lot of people are voting in schools in the primary. That's coming up on Tuesday. And they asked me, what happens if we can't open the schools because there's not power there by Tuesday? And I said I'd be really angry if the schools were not open, available for voting on Tuesday.
And I can follow up to say that Chairman Gillette from PURA convened a task force today of the utilities and all related agencies. The Secretary of State's office participated in that call. So all the information has provided to the extent that there are any polling locations that have been impacted by outages. The utilities have that information so that they can prioritize those for restoration. So I feel confident that those priorities will be addressed.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Hi, good afternoon. Recently, it was reported by DOL that its contact center is operating at 50%. In what other ways has the outages affected the department with so many people still seeking unemployment?
You know that, Paul?
I can take that too.
Or Josh?
Okay, we got a little bit of a breakup in the audio there. Let's go to Josh Jabal.
Is running on a backup generator at this point. Their main headquarters is on backup. So we are concerned about that. If that generator were to fail, that would kick down their systems and could potentially impact the processing of unemployment compensation this week. But so far, that system is holding up. That particular site is escalated with Eversource, along with a number of other critical facilities that we are trying to prioritize to ensure power is restored.
All right, there you have it from Josh Jabal. Question regarding the Department of Labor. County's home for UConn sports, UConn men and women's basketball and UConn men's football, WICC. But another one of these stories that kind of dribbled under the radar over the past couple of days because of the massive storm that we had to encounter and now cleaning up from, there is only one what used to be termed Division One football that is now the bowl the FBS, the football bowl, the FBS division of of college football. There's only one of those programs that has said they are definitely not going to play at all this year. There's only one football bowl subdivision team that says, no, we're not playing at all. We're not going to play a shortened schedule. We're not going to play in the spring. The UConn Huskies. With us to talk about that is our UConn guy. He has a great podcast with his buddies, instoresnow.com. Check out the website. Check out the podcast. That's instoresnow.com as opposed to stores. You see how that works, folks? Pretty snappy, kids. Brian Forrester is with us. Brian, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Were you surprised? Were you surprised that UConn went this far? Because I figured, okay, they'll play a shorter schedule, or you know what would be cool, some spring football. You know, maybe right after the pros get done. Did this surprise you and the folks that cover UConn?
It seems like it made sense. You know, they moved to independent. They had some of their games already canceled, so you're looking at it, and they said they're going to cancel the games because of safety, but it's money is what it comes down to. I mean, sure, safety's got to play a factor in it, but it's got to be money. You're going to lose less money by not playing than they would had they played. So I like it. I like it. It seems the reaction to it has been positive. It's nice to see UConn football leading the way on something. It's been a while for that. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, when it comes out and the reaction is kind of, well, that makes sense, then – you know, I think it was a good decision, and you know, here we are.
And again, you're looking, Brian, at a scenario where, okay, if they did play some games, and granted, they had attendance problems last year, but okay, let's say they played a shortened schedule or whatever. You know, they're a Rentschler Field with, you know, no fans in the stand. There's no revenue there. They're already being criticized because of overspending and a perceived lack of fan support. So, yeah, when you come right down to it, there are two things that they would have had challenges with this year anyway, had there not been a whole COVID-19 thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, you know, the landscape for them is kind of changed as an independent. They had games scheduled against Indiana and Illinois, Big Ten schools who announced that they were going to be playing conference-only schedules. They had two games scheduled, with one with UNC and the other with Virginia, which ACC came out with their schedule. Obviously, UConn wasn't going to be in it. So what are you going to do? Are you going to play UMass 10 times and call it a day? I mean, you know, Liberty would have been around to play, but yeah. I think this makes sense. It makes sense for all the parties involved. UConn is not an old team. They don't have a lot of seniors. You can probably save a year of eligibility for the couple seniors there, looking at 2021. And then you let these guys basically take the equivalent of a redshirt year, hit the weight room, get into class, whatever that looks like. It's not a bad thing for UConn football when you look at, you know, big picture.
So this is not – so, Brian, as you read it, and your buddies there at InStores Now, this is not going to affect – how are they saying this – the eligibility of these guys? So they're not going to lose a year of eligibility here, correct?
That's my understanding. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be – David Benedict, the athletic director, said it's a way to preserve some of these guys' eligibility. Mm-hmm. There's a couple guys who are going to make an impact as a senior, but for the most part, they're a young team. So, yeah. You know, you've got the running back, Mensah, who had a great year last year. Hopefully, if he wants to play next year, then they've got a spot for him.
So yeah, they can. So these seniors could, right, Brian, they could come back and do a grad year if there's no NFL sniffs or Canadian League or whatever. They could just, you know, take 500-level courses instead of 400-level courses.
Or who knows, right? You got The Rock buying the XFL now.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so bottom line is you're not surprised. And now do you think, you know, now that the first domino has gone here and there will be no UConn football this year, you think other teams in UConn's position may fall in line here?
Well, I think it's because they're an independent. Yeah. They've got the flexibility to do that. They don't have the big TV revenue that was coming in for some of these other conferences. So I wouldn't be shocked if other teams wind up canceling. I've been joking with friends all along, said there's not going to be any college football. I mean, they're trying to have it, but
yeah,
you know, who knows? So you make the best decisions you can with the information available to you, and then hopefully there's basketball. I know Coach Hurley has said he's optimistic there'll be a season.
Yeah.
Figure out what that looks like, but
yeah.
No need to cancel anything, I think, that starts in November, December just yet. Let's wait and see what happens.
All right. Brian Forrester from InStoresNow.com. Check out the podcast and the website, InStoresNow.com. Brian, as always, go Huskies, and thanks for the input. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go. So no UConn football this year, probably partly because, as Brian explained, they're not in a conference. And what all these other teams are doing that would have been playing UConn as an out-of-conference game, you know, for a check, UConn would have picked up a nice check for the school to, you know, get their rear ends handed to them by some bigger teams. Now those games aren't on the schedule, so UConn is who do you play? So that's why they had to do it, too.